Hello, podcast listener. Do you like...
Ready to form Voltron!
Or maybe... How about...
I am Batman!
Or...
This is a job for Superman!
Do you remember...
Power Rangers!
Or this...
Right away, Michael.
Or maybe even this...
Autobots! Transform!
Or this...
By the power of Grayskull!
Or...
For the honor of Grayskull!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
Hello. I'm the Doctor.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then check out Charlie's Geekcast, hosted by me, Charlie Niemeyer. Charlie's Geekcast is a bi-weekly podcast covering comics and other geek stuff. The first episode of each month is devoted to comics, where I look at random comics from my collection. The other episode of the month is devoted to whatever else I want to talk about, such as movies, TV shows, cartoons, video games, and more. Feel free to check it out at www.charliesgeekcast.com.
It's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
How much is that dog in the window?
Hello, horror hats! This time on the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, we have Dario Argente's Tenebrae. This is a movie with a very ill-behaved dog in it. Unlike my dog. There he is. My dog, Schultzy. I've been training him with his shock collar. Look! Okay, Schultzy, sit!
Okay, just a minute. Ow! Okay, I'm sitting down now on things.
Schultzy, shake hands.
Ah, hello. I am Schultzy. I am a good dog. A good dog, damn it!
Speak!
Hello, I am Schultzy. I am a good...
Speak right, Schultzy.
Wolf. Bark. Bark. Rye. Ram. Rotzy. Bark. Bark.
Good boy. Now, play dead.
I don't know how. I never die in my movies. You got me. I will be back.
Isn't he a good little pup? Well, before we get to the movie, I would like to request that you do as I am doing this afternoon. Have your pet spayed and neutered by a licensed veterinarian. Or, in my case, some drunk who I'm going to pay $50 to.
Wait. What? No! Not the chopper!
How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggies, I do hope that doggies, I do hope that doggies for sale!
Good, Schultzy.
Ciao, Lee Miamici, and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am one of your co-hosts, Luke Giaconetti, and as always, I am joined by the usual gang of freaks. First, my good friend, Mr. Hair Metal Hero.
Hey!
We're getting real kind of minimalist tonight, and slightly more north, my good friend, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Hey, he stole my line.
And
style, though, man.
Yeah, all style. It's delivery.
And my our Western contingent, Mr. Sean Engel.
Howdy.
That's how
why not?
And starts a show right there.
I can almost see the 10-gallon hat on his head.
That's all I have on, surprisingly.
Oh, no!
There you go.
Well, that works, because our film is Tenebrae, directed by Dario Argento, and this is a film appropriate enough for this group about aberrant sexuality. So,
Freeverts!
Tenebrae was released in Italy in 1982, was released over here in the States in 1984 in heavily cut form under the hilarious title Unsane. It's not insane, but unsane. And then was finally brought over in the late 90s by Anchor Bay in uncut form on DVD, and that's what most of us are watching tonight. So what do you guys think, Tenebrae?
I loved it.
Same here. This is my second watch, because you actually recommended me watch this before we got into this whole thing about Italian films. And on the second time, I caught even more stuff, and I really enjoyed it as well.
Meh.
Really?
Chris is going to be the dissenting voice here.
He's going to be the wet blanket this time.
Well, you know, that's why they make 31 flavors of ice cream, because some of you like shitty ice cream.
That's true.
You only need chocolate. It's the only one you need.
Story of Tenebrae follows American, essentially a giallo author named Peter Neal, who is traveling to Rome to promote his new book, appropriately titled Tenebrae. But once he lands in Rome, people start getting killed. Women start getting killed, to be specific, with pages of the book shoved in their mouths. And the killer contacts Neal. And it seems that the killer has become obsessed with Neal's work, and including Neal's aversion to what we refer to, again, as aberrant sexuality, as he punishes those who feels are promiscuous and, you know, of that nature. And things get out of hand quickly, as this is an Argento film, but we start right off with, very early on, a very brutal murder of a woman with a razor blade, and things just kind of ramp up from there in terms of violence and gore.
You're
that
right.
What happens.
You do. I gotta tell you, I almost don't want the Italian movies to end, because I'm just now here's something I wanted to ask you guys who watched on DVD. I watched on YouTube, and it might have been the transfer to YouTube, but was there some weird
optical every time they move the camera?
Yeah,
that's what I noticed.
Were you watching it on YouTube also?
I watched it on YouTube as well, yes.
Yes, and I think that might have been just something of when they transferred it to YouTube. If not, that's the trippiest effect any director's ever done for an extended length of time.
No, I think that must be an artifact, because I watched it on... I own this one on DVD, and I don't know what you're referring to.
Yeah, I watched it on DVD as well, and... I didn't really get anything like that, so it might be something that was specific to
It was just that version. Okay, good.
We suck.
Because I would have thought that would have been a bad decision by the director. And it was just a bad decision of what I decided to watch it on.
Yes.
But, I loved everything about it. I loved the music with the cheesy vocoder in it, and boobs a-popping everywhere.
Oh yeah, those are good boobies.
A lesbian double murder. That's something you can always enjoy in any horror movie ever.
And a transsexual actress kicking the shit out of somebody.
I had no idea that until I like read up more on the movie that actress was, you know, not female, because I thought she was hot.
Which actress was this?
It moved. Did it move, Sean? It moved
just a bit.
What?
The one in the sort of dream sequences, right? The one or the flashback.
The one with the red shoes.
The red shoes. And
oh, really? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, that was a dude.
Had me fooled, man. I didn't see no Adam's apple or nothing. She looked had that 80s sort of spiral perm cutie look. Damn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, though, but the thing with that, those sequences, I mean, the first one of those where we see, and spoilers full on, we see Peter, you know, remembering in kind of a nightmarish way events from his past where, you know, he comes up and she's got all of the other boys on the beach, and it's we're seeing it through Peter Neal's POV. He slaps her, and then he's chased down, and essentially she orally rapes him with the red pump. Mm-hmm. And of all the, you know, and this is a film that has a woman literally getting her arm chopped off and spraying blood like a football. But the image of them pinning him down and, you know, forcibly violating him with the red pump, high heel shoe like that, that to me is one of the most striking images of Tenebrae, and just one of the just absolute, you know, kind of churning a little bit. It's so, it's such a cruel type of act, you know. And so when we see then the second one, where again we're seeing through Peter Neal's eyes, where just simply stabbing her right in the stomach a couple of times, just completely unflinchingly, and then she goes down in a heap. It's, you know, it really puts, I think it puts us into Peter's mindset. So when we get to the twist at the end, we can see why he's, you know, batshit loco off the deep end crazy.
Yeah, it just comes out of nowhere. Though I watching it, I was like, what? Did we go into another movie? It really is jarring the first time they have that dream sequence. Oh, that memory sequence. It threw me for a loop.
Well, that's really what this movie was constantly just throwing red herrings and different bits of information. And just when you thought you had everything in play, it would throw in another or a weird dream sequence or stuff. So you really had to... Well, you don't really have to, like, super pay attention, but you got to keep track of what's going on for the twist at the end. And a lot of it fooled me a little bit because I just expected it to be a woman until I saw man hands. There was one scene where the hands, like, were big hairy hands, and I'm like, oh, the killer's not a woman.
Well, and they could kind of disguise it because they did the typical trope of most of the murders when they were committed, the person was committing them with the black leather gloves. Yeah.
Right. And there just seemed to be a lot of crazy or potentially crazy women in it. Maybe it's just because I'm getting used to that in these Italian films. It's just like the crazy woman did it. So yeah. They saw the ex-wife character. You knew something was up there, you know?
And when Peter is at the airport and he is interviewed by Tilda, his former student, who basically calls him on the carpet and says, why do you hate women? All the women in your books are ciphers and misogynists. This was kind of a metatextual aspect because this exact criticism was very often leveled at Argento himself. That the women in his films existed merely to either be killed in spectacular fashion or to help move the plot along. So in this film, it's rather telling that the majority of the female characters are in fact victims and ciphers.
Yeah.
The woman who herself becomes a victim as part of the double murder with the two lesbians. So it's, you know, a lot of it is the idea that, you know, women are not always portrayed well. It only gets worse, is the crazy thing with Argento. Once he and Daria Nicolota separate, until he starts casting his daughter in things, treatment of women just continues to go down. Amazing. But, I mean, you've got Anne, who's dead, aforementioned Daria Nicolota, looking beautiful as always. She's, you know, there pretty much to help the plot move along. All she does is move from place to place and make things happen. Mm-hmm. You've got his wife, Jane, who's the ultimate red herring nut job.
Yeah.
And then we have a series of, you know, of victims, of women who get, you know, are introduced, they get a little bit of play, and then are hacked to bits. So it's like Argento just spitting in the face of the critics saying, you want victims? I'll give you female victims.
Well, speaking of victims, the two, and it's because I want to go back to them because they were naked, or one of them was naked throughout most of the film. Yeah. The two lesbian victims, they were basically given the barest minimum of plot development.
Right.
And before they were brutally murdered. So they really had no connection to the movie aside from just being there to look good and be naked and fight. But that also led to one of the kind of unique shots in the film, the that crane shot that they did, and that was one of the things I thought was kind of striking in this film.
The crane shot was great. I'll give it that. That was a hell of a shot.
One thing that's amazing, that's I've actually seen Unsane. The it used to be Movie Gallery. Before that, it was Movies. By my where my wife and I lived, when we were living off campus at Clemson University, which has since closed, unfortunately. Not the video store, not the university. We used to rent, they used to have every Tuesday was two for movie rental. And I'd always rent a horror movie and she'd rent whatever she wanted to see. And I remember renting Unsane one day and they actually cut that pan. They cut the crane shot right in the middle. It's absolutely amazing. And that the they don't make no effort to try and fix the soundtrack. It just completely jumps and it's the most jarring, ridiculous thing in the world. That whole sequence, starting from when we first see their kind of apartment, but their brownstone that they live in, from them fighting, and then the crane shot, and then the two murders themselves. Both of those murders are beautifully realized and incredibly violent. You know, Tilda getting, she's pulling her shirt over her head, and then the razor blade slashes the shirt, and then just slashes her in the face. It's, you know, just that blood just splashing right on her face is very immediate on the white, you know, the white shirt, her pale skin, and then her girlfriend getting slashed in the back and then her head smashing through the mirror is iconic for the film. The one sheet for Tenebrae was derived from that scene of her hanging through the mirror with the blood running down her neck and her hair hanging down through it. I mean, that's a solid, you know, 5-6 minutes of just, you know, filmmaking without much dialogue at all, just some yelling. And some, you know, some real good mise-en-scène between the camera work, the lighting, the music, and then it all just builds to this, you know, extremely violent crescendo.
Yeah, I mean, all the murder set pieces in this are really well done. I was not engaged, though, outside of those, which is a problem when it's sort of a character-based piece like it is about the author there.
See, that's
but that's just me.
No, see, that's interesting because Tenebrae got a bad reputation when it was first released. It wasn't until at least 10, 15 years after its release that it was started to be reevaluated, and some critics hold it as Argento's most well put together film, insofar as this is often the one, like I did with Sean, that I would recommend be somebody's first Argento film to watch, just because it's the most literal and it makes the most sense. So I said,
I'll definitely give it that.
Yeah,
I'll definitely give it that. It's definitely, you know, more straight ahead than Suspiria, but
yes,
yeah, I think more straight ahead than Suspiria, so possibly Inferno. But I said, I'm really interested in hearing your opinion of why, you know, like I said, the characters didn't really connect with you compared to some of the other stuff we've watched.
You know what it is? I think with a lot of horror movies, I go in expecting that element of the fantastic, which, you know, the other films we've watched, but, you know, for the Italian series sort of have.
Yes.
This one, it almost, everything outside of the murders seemed almost like TV to me.
Like a crime drama.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's what it was going for. This was more of, you know, what Luke considers to be a stereotypical giallo. It's a crime mystery. It's a murder mystery with your writer of horror books or writer of crime mysteries coming in to try and solve it. So it really doesn't have that much of a supernatural aspect other than sort of the odd way that, or not really odd way, but the unique way that Argento films the shots.
And it has Mario and Luigi in it. Did you guys catch them?
Yep.
And I was looking at them. I'm like, why are those two standing out to me? It's Mario and Luigi.
I completely missed that.
There's two guys. There's a sort of swarthy guy and then a tall, skinny guy in overalls. And they just sort of, I think maybe they even have a ladder with them or something. But they're sort of like workmen.
Huh.
They're the guys fixed the elevator,
right?
But the killer. And
right. Okay.
Cristiano leaves the letter after he kills the lesbians, and he's stuck. And that's one thing I like also about this is that Cristiano, the who we actually, and again, this follows another trope of other Argento films and giallo in general, that we meet Cristiano, we meet the killer very early on in a very innocuous sort of way. He's in the background at the airport, and John Saxon, my boy John Saxon, is like, oh, that's the TV host that you're going to be doing the show with. And then we meet him when Peter does the TV show. And we don't really give him a second thought, other than he's way too interested in Peter Negan.
That stuck out like a sore thumb to me, man.
Yeah, it was like almost it
really did.
Red herring.
Yeah.
It was almost too obvious of a red herring.
But I like that he is clearly, while he's enthusiastic, he's not exactly a professional. He makes multitudes of mistakes. You know, he goes to pick up a prostitute to kill her, he gets there too late and the prostitute he wants with somebody else and he just kind of panics and speeds away. You know, he gets stuck at the elevator and can't leave the hotel after he leaves the note for Peter. You know, he manages to, for a while, be outrun and outwitted by a 16-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
Again, nothing says classy like hacking a 16-year-old girl to bits with an axe.
That dog was ruthless, man. That was like the Terminator dog.
That dog would way too interested. That's all I gotta say. Extremely.
That dog had some ups, man. That thing could jump.
Yeah.
I think she must have been carrying around like a snossage in her pocket. Or something.
Right.
She had just recently gone to get some prosciutto or something.
Yeah, prosciutto.
I don't know. Like I said, I can understand where you're coming from with that because it's even Profondo Rosso had the element of the supernatural because it dealt with, you know, the Olga could see the future and she read the killer's mind before all that began. Whereas this really is just kind of a hard-boiled crime drama. And I'll agree that a lot of it does have that sort of almost, you know, harshly overlit kind of TV police procedural. And a lot of that was intentional. Argento wanted to overlight this. He's talked about that for... And I've never gotten this while watching the film or reading about it, but Argento has said that he wanted this to seem like it was taking place kind of in the future, that it was Rome that was recognizable somewhat as Rome, but it was a lot less populated, and that something must have happened to reduce the population. I don't get any of that.
I didn't get that at all.
Yeah, I don't like Rome to me.
But there was a scene where his agent was sitting in the square waiting for his ex-wife to show up. And he's watching, you know, it's like a busy... There's a kid bouncing a ball. There's a couple fighting. You know, there's all these things going on that he's just sort of observing and people watching. And it gives almost the opposite impression of a bustling...
Yeah, I don't
very active city.
I don't know what Argento was talking about.
Maybe he might be a little insane.
Dun, dun, dun.
The only thing that I could see that might have been futuristic about it was some of the set design, especially near the end. When they get to the final killing with the woman getting her hand hacked off, and the again harkening back to the sort of white background of that with the blood spraying all over that, and then the oddly designed piece of metal structure, the thing that in the end,
you first saw it, you thought that thing's gonna kill somebody.
Yep.
Yeah, a big
that
pointy
thing's really
metal
pointy
silver
and
thing.
Metal-y, yeah, and heavy looking. That's somebody's gonna die with that.
And it thankfully, you know, Chekhov's gun. It was put there, and by
Chekhov's
the end,
statue.
It actually Chekhov's statue. That's what it is.
I remember when I watched this with my group of friends back at Clemson when we would do our horror festicon. This was the first Argento movie we watched, and actually, at the time, one of my friends made the comment that it's Europe. The art obviously needs an adapter. No, but I mean, I don't know. That's it. But as a straight giallo, I've always enjoyed Tenebrae, and one thing that I like is that it hits on. It hits on a lot of points, but it really, in a sense, it kind of cheats a little bit because, you know, obviously there's stuff that we're not privy to, But if when you've watched it, like Sean was saying, you got more out of it watching it the second time. I think once you've seen it and you know what the twist is coming, a lot of that stuff that's set up is, you know, it becomes more plain. One thing that I like that I hadn't noticed or really thought about until I watched this past time is when Christiana is, when he's committing the killings, Argento makes a point of showing us Peter doing something else right before the murder takes place to purposefully, you know, make us think, oh, well, Peter can't be the killer because he was in the hotel room with Anne when the killer did, you know, kill the lesbian. So he's giving us an alibi for mm-hmm. Peter for his first couple mm-hmm. of kills. As soon as Cristiano is killed, that stops happening. And I never really noticed until this time. I never put really two and two together. That as soon as Cristiano is killed, and Peter says his great line of, you know, someone is dead who should be alive, or somebody's ready to be dead. And now it's like, okay, well, now we've already established in your mind this idea that, well, it can't be Peter. Well, yeah, it kind of was.
That was good. I'm wondering if the whole part where, when he's finally revealed, when he sort of goes into gibbering idiot, if maybe that wasn't just an act. In case he did get hauled in, he could say he was insane because he was still thinking. He was still thinking because he had the fake razor blade. And this is another movie where just everybody but one character pretty much is dead by the end of this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and who survives? It's Daria Nicolodi.
Yeah.
She's the one who survives the end. So it helps, I guess, to be the spouse of the director in this movie.
Right.
You make it out alive.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true because I was saying this. My wife caught she's seen Tenebrae, so she knows the story. She came in with about 30 minutes to go, which is right when everything comes off the rails.
Right.
John's like, you got to see all the crazy bits and none of the talky bits. That's pretty good. but again, something else that I like is it's just from a plotting standpoint, everything kind of comes together. You know, Peter Neal is accused early on of writing fiction that is, you know, gratuitously violent towards women. And then we learn that, yes, he does. He denies it. He tries to be intellectual about it. But his own psychology is made up of revenge fantasy against women because of what happened in his past and the psychological trauma that not only being attacked by this woman, but then killing her and getting away with it. Has done to him and the position that's put him in mentally. So you can, again, you can then buy it when he again, Chris, you mentioned when he breaks down gibbering at the end and he says, it was like a book. So Cristiano has become obsessed with fiction and making that reality. But Peter looks at reality and thinks, oh, it's fiction. It's fiction. It's
right.
Heavy man.
I thought you were going to have a comment on that hero. What
is this? That's crazy, man. It is heavy.
I don't know. Maybe I'm thinking too much into it at this point.
No, I mean everything that's being said is perfectly good commentary. It's probably something I should watch again with maybe a more critical eye. You probably won't, right?
I mean, if I were you, I would. Yeah, you know, if you really like, I don't know, with movies like that, when I don't really like them, if sometimes there's something that intrigues me about them and that'll get me to watch them again. But I'm just saying, don't watch it again.
I'll probably treat it like I treat Blade Runner, and it's a movie that I have a love-hate fascination with. It's one of those movies that I have to keep watching because I feel like I'm missing something every time.
I remember going back to visit my dad once, and he'd seen Dances with Wolves. And he's like, have you seen Dances with Wolves? And I'm like, no. And he's like, it's one of the only movies I went out and bought on video. And I'm like, oh, did you really like it? And he's like, I don't think so. But I've watched it like 5 times. That being said,
it's something I'd rather watch over the multitude of crap that usually we get bombarded with on TV and at the movies, so... it had boobies and murders in it, so I had that going for it.
Ultimately, isn't that when, you know, something we've seen over the course of watching Argento, isn't that kind of the distillation of him? It's got sex and violence, and oftentimes together, you know. It's Argento's a filmmaker who's gotten by a lot of times just on style over substance. And so that's one thing I like about Tenebrae. There's a lot of meat to that story. It's not just visual, but at the same time, that makes it a little bit different. You know, you mentioned that you didn't find a lot of the characters engaging. This is a common criticism of Argento. Some of the films that would come after this would feature essentially Argento moving his actors through set pieces just to get them in the right spots and then
to get killed.
I mean, a real good example of that is the film Opera, which Opera is a film that has a lot of good parts in it, but ultimately exists simply for the set pieces. It exists simply because Argento wanted to shoot certain things. There's the most well-known scene from Opera, again, has Daria Nicolodi. She is the agent for a young opera singer, and the opera singer has locked herself in the room with her agent, and she's looking through the peephole, and there's supposedly an Italian police officer outside showing her the badge through the peephole, and she puts her eye down to the peephole, and the guy shoots a pistol through the peephole, through her eye, out her head, and then hits the phone behind her. And it's this amazing shot. And if you listen to Argento, he concocted this shot and then figured out a way to put it in the film. It wasn't...
right.
It didn't grow organically. Of course, the other behind that is that is right when Argento and Nicolodi were kind of on the outs, and she really thought that he was trying to kill her. She honestly believed that Argento was going to figure out a way to kill her on set and make
Jesus.
It... Yeah. So...
The Italian film industry is crazy, man. It is crazy. The stories that further down the road, we're going to hear about, you know, actors being brought in front of the police to say, no, I am alive. I'm actually alive. I was not chopped up into pieces.
Well, and, you know, that was like Black Sunday. You know, Barbara Steele thought that they were going to use special cameras to shoot through her clothes. You know,
well, would you put it past them?
No, I wouldn't. That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Exactly. So it's, but I'll tell you what a performance that would get. You're doing a horror movie and your actress is in fear for her life. You know, you're going to get that visceral realism.
Yep.
You're not going to make friends.
I'm not going to make movies.
Yeah,
here's the problem with killing your actors. You can only kill them once, and then they can't work for you again.
Yeah.
It's like that old Daffy Duck cartoon, where he's got his human devil routine, where he puts on the devil suit and drinks gasoline and swallows them. Yeah. Agent says, oh, that's brilliant, that's fantastic. He goes, there's only one problem, I can only do it once.
Yeah. That one always kills.
What I've liked again about the kind of the murder set pieces, I think that's something we can all speak about with glowing admiration.
Oh, yeah.
In Deep Red, all the set pieces were set up so that it was something that we could have a familiar feeling with. You know, the guy's teeth are bashed into the mantle because we've all poked ourselves on a hard surface, that kind of thing. Here, everything involves, with only one exception, you know, penetrative blade violence. And it's like, we really need to just push that psychosexual violence aspect over the top. And we're just, you know, John Saxon is stabbed to death with the same knife that is used in the nightmare sequences. I always thought that was kind of neat. After Jane gets the gift of the red pumps, and it's like, shit's getting real up in here, right? all the women are all, you know, really heinously dispatched in various states of undress. You know, the 16, you know, the girl whose name I don't have.
Maria.
Yeah, I mean, she is, you know, first off, kudos to her. She's just been chased by this really extremely motivated dog for like 6 miles. She runs into the killer's hideout, is smart enough not to, you know, just immediately run away, but to actually grab the evidence.
Yes.
That's pretty good quick thinking for someone who's just had a dog chasing him for 20 minutes.
That was me. I was the dog.
Hey, baby.
Oh, wait. She was jailbait.
Then,
I would pay $50 to see you jump a fence like that dog did, a chain link fence like that, though.
That was incredible.
I think you'd need a catapult to jump a fence.
You see, I'm not at all convinced that dog wasn't using a tramp. They didn't have an off-screen trampoline for that dog, because that was some amazing.
Have you ever tried to get a dog on a trampoline? It's difficult.
Have you?
No, and I wouldn't try to.
I have not done that, but I have put a cat on a treadmill, which is just hilarious.
Ooh.
A dog will walk on a treadmill. A cat will simply sit on it till they fall off the end and then look at you indignantly.
Yeah.
Because cats are stupid.
Do that? Yeah.
But then, Cristiano, this guy is not a professional killer. You know, the girl slams the door in his arm and he loses his razor blade in his little koi pond. But to his credit, he then is fast on his feet and grabs the giant axe. And it's her getting just chomped right in the gut. That is, ouch, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was one of the characters I kind of liked in the movie, too. She seemed to be one of the more, you know, just sort of normal, well-adjusted characters.
She was. She just got in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Cristiano was as upset that he killed her, too, which is interesting.
I thought they were sort of setting it up for maybe the people suspecting his valet there of killing, because their last scene together, you know, they had a fight and she ran off.
Right, yep.
And it's weird. He sort of recovered, though, from, you know, he didn't seem to be too torn up with guilt that, like, he dropped her off on the bike and then she got killed immediately afterwards.
I almost wonder if it wasn't him. It wasn't supposed to be him, because I think it's a different bike. I'd have to go back and look at that. I always assumed it was his little valet guy, but it might.
Right.
Maybe
I thought it was too, because they're making out before they're even out the door when they leave together.
Right, he's smacking her on the ass and stuff.
But I would too.
Actually, I also think it's funny when she goes up to her father, giving you an idea of the economy of Italy at the time. She puts out her hand and asks for $1,000.
Yeah,
which is like it's like $5.
Right, go out and get a bite to eat, right?
But I really like the bit where she comes to the room to turn on the hot water, and it's very obvious that Peter is way too interested in an underage girl. You know, he's kind of flirting with her a little bit.
Oh, he's playing along, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like. He's like, okay, now that's like this guy, you know, okay, he's been so far a pretty decent, reasonable guy, but why is he this interested in a young girl like this?
Unless, did you see the ass on her? I mean, come on. they said she was 17 in the movie.
That's right, she was 17. But still, it's almost, again, it's something that foreshadows his kind of obsession with women. You know, this girl's the daughter of the landlord. This is coming to turn the water on, and he's thinking, I get lucky, or maybe I could, you know, run her through with a pipe or something.
Or both.
Yeah, pipe, both. Yeah.
Well, something Hiro and I were discussing before we started recording was, and I think this might be where a little of the split happens, is the music. Because I'm getting to the point where I like that. I've always liked goblin music, but like, it doesn't feel goofy to me anymore. Or it doesn't have that goofy foreign feel to it, an out of place feel that it used to have for me. You know, with the like rock instruments and the just lurid, over the top, you know, sort of aspect to it.
I liked the music. I found it completely out of place and way too. But it's not even so much that. It's just that it was such a foreshadowing, a harbinger of, you knew when you heard that kick in, you knew there was going to be a murder.
Right.
It was just. I know that's the point, but it threw me for some reason. It almost pulled me out of the movie because I was like, oh, all right, murder's about to happen.
See, but that's what we see in in the American, I mean, in the movie that we're going to be covering later, the Friday the 13th movie, the music and the sound effects, you know, symbolize a murder or something bad going to happen as well. So
they're not quite as disco, though.
Yeah, it's not.
But I don't. But I don't expect anything from an American slasher film.
Oh well, there you go.
It's, you know, that the soundtrack to Tenebrae is kind of an oddball one because it does have the really recognizable theme, which is used several times over. It's right at the beginning. It's used obviously, but then it's got again. Chris, you made the reference that it was very disco. For 1982 in Italy, yeah, that disco was still it. So
yeah,
it's not as prog rock, I think, as we saw in either Profondo Rosso or Suspiria. It definitely has more of the disco pop sort of sound to it, which is, again, for something that with such lurid, kind of grounded subject matter is kind of an interesting juxtaposition. It does rub some people the wrong way. I've always liked it, but I like strange soundtracks like that. I've always been kind of attracted to that, so I'm probably just more prone. The type of music that we get here, Hiro's absolutely right. Argento uses it as a tool to foreshadow and to tell us to really set the mise-en-scene and set the stage, and it does become kind of a theme that if you hear the music, bad stuff's going to happen. But Sean's also right. That is, again, something we see in American films. It's cinematic shorthand. It's easy to do that if the audience can, identify that piece of music with bad stuff. You know, they know, don't get popcorn now. You know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's hard sometimes to address these films as anything but commercial. I think Tenebrae was at the stage where Argento had made his money. He was coming off of a kind of a film that didn't do a lot of good business with Inferno, and Tenebrae was a way, I think, to just make some money for him in a lot of ways. That it ended up being one that was, in retrospect, seen as a critical success was almost a aberration. When you look again at Inferno before it, and then films like Inferno, The Stendhal Syndrome, Opera, there's a few others that come after that really were neither critical nor commercial successes. I think this is probably the last great gasp from Argento before his decline. Now, there are quality films that he made, but this is probably the last really good one.
Yeah, big sort of as a whole thing. Yeah, because I haven't seen any of his later stuff, but I heard it really descended into cheesiness.
The one that comes immediately after this is Phenomena, which is of interest to a lot of American fans because it has Jennifer Connelly in it. And that's and Donald Pleasance and his helper monkey. This is a strange movie.
Oh, well, now I'm in.
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly. Oh, yeah.
No, you had me with helper monkey.
Oh, my God.
As a girl at a boarding school who can control insects with her mind.
Oh!
Oh, yeah. Bug movie, okay. All right.
Are there bugs versus monkeys at some point?
Not, unfortunately, no. There are not bugs.
That's bugs. My Kickstarter that I'm trying to start up. I want to make that movie. Yeah.
Phenomena was known in the U.S. as Creepers, and they changed all the... There's one poster, one sheet, with Jennifer Connelly holding her hand out and a swarm of insects flying into her hand, and the U.S. distributor changed it so that half her face was eaten off. It's like nothing like that even remotely happens in the movie. Not even close.
Oh my God. I actually remember seeing that cover now at the video store.
Mm-hmm. That Creepers was a bit, again, because it has two recognizable Americans as lead roles, got a lot of play both on video and on HBO. But you look at
Pleasance is American?
Well, okay, you know what I mean. Well-known to American audiences. How about that?
Yeah, yeah.
Big from the Halloween movies, for sure, at that point.
But you look at...
I was going to delve into my character of him, but I won't do it.
But you look at Phenomenon, then Opera, then Trauma, Stendhal Syndrome, his remake of The Phantom of the Opera, which is really just poor. Those films were...
I couldn't even get through that one. I tried watching it.
I tried. I gave up. I mean, it's like Julian Sands as the Phantom of the Opera on paper sounds real good. It's not, you know. I don't want the listeners to think that, oh, you know, Giaconetti's just a mark for any Italian director. I'm not. You know, when Argento's good, he's really damn good. When he's bad, he's pretty damn bad. things got a little in the 2000s. We got Sleepless. I liked Sleepless a lot. Non Ho Sono is its Italian name. The Card Player was pretty good, but again, kind of harkens back to Tenebrae with it being just kind of a very straight giallo. We finally got the third part of the Mother's trilogy with the Mother of Tears, which was, again, throwing back more to Suspiria with the crazy kind of nightmare imagery and dream logic. And it became kind of evident that his best days were behind him, but he's still producing new material. So I'd prefer to watch something like this from the guy's prime and examine it from a critical light than to say, wow, look how bad this guy's got. Look how small. You know, and again, I don't mean to overstate it. These are all, most of these films are pretty good. Phantom of the Opera's not. And most of the others are worth watching. But when you come from such a high to come to such a relative low, it's a little depressing.
That's why I like DiMonzo, because he just kept that sort of same level of mediocrity
for
his whole career.
You know, I'm still amazed to this day that Signore DiMonzo never hooked up with Charles Band. And I think there must be a story there somehow.
It might be, you know.
Because they seem like perfect pairs. For
just because they didn't do anything together doesn't mean they didn't meet, you know. They
met. Oh, they met. And if you knew what happened when they met, then you'd know why they never worked together.
See, got to be a story there, you know.
It involves cards and alcohol. I'll say no more. I'm sworn to secrecy.
And for sure.
Molester Bot will come after me if I say any more.
Oh, wouldn't that be awesome? A Demonic Toys Molester Bot.
That's my other Kickstarter. Shut up.
Well, like I said, I enjoyed watching as a kind of a capstone on the Argento portion of our Italian primer. And next time out, we're going to be moving in a totally different direction. So I think we've kind of covered all the bases. Anyone have any last thoughts you want to talk about Tenebrae before we move on and talk about what we're going to be watching next time?
Good crime story.
I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sean.
I'm sorry. Good crime story. I enjoyed it. Lots of neat violence.
Great set pieces. Didn't connect with me the way I thought it would.
Fair enough.
I'll accept that. So what do we got coming up next, though?
Well, actually, it's kind of an appropriate segue, because there is a cameo appearance in Tenebrae by the director of our next film. When they go to Cristiano's house to investigate his death, one of the crime scene investigators is none other than Lucio Fulci. He's the older guy who's balding, wearing a beard and glasses. And Fulci was a contemporary. He's actually a contemporary of Mario Bava. And he's a bit older than Argento, but the two of them are intrinsically linked together because they produced a lot of films at the same, you know, during the same era, during the 70s and 80s. And so we're going to be moving into a couple of films from the late, great Lucio Fulci, known in most circles as the godfather of gore. Because if you thought that Argento was over the top with the splatter, Fulci's a whole other revelation. So we're going to be watching Zombie.
Ooh, nice. I've seen that one.
Yeah, just
a little. That's the shark.
That is the one with the shark, yes.
All right.
Oh, wow. I've only heard about this one. I can't.
It's quite impressive.
Now, Zombie, you need to. There's a little. I'll give you a little bit of background. We'll talk about this next time, but just so that you can track it down. Zombie, Zombie,
mm-hmm.
film by Lucio Fulci. Zombie, Zombie, is the re-edited version of Dawn of the Dead that Dario Argento prepared for the Italian market. Zombie 2, Zombie 2, is the same film as Zombie, Zombie. Okay? Zombie 2, Zombie 2, was titled that way to make people think it was a sequel to Zombie, Zombie.
What?
Yeah, right. Just seek out the film called Zombie, Zombie, and you will be okay, because that was the title that Anchor Bay released it under. When Shriek Show got a hold of it, they released it as Zombie 2, and the whole thing went ass over tea kettle, to quote my brother. So just look. I know that Zombie is available on Netflix. I checked this out before we got on, so definitely check that one out, because, I mean, I know zombies are popular nowadays. I don't want to sound like a hipster, but I liked zombies way before they were popular, mostly because of this.
Yeah, man.
I liked zombies before they were dead.
Give it to people. Man, I like my zombies voodoo from Haiti, man. All kidding aside, definitely check out Zombie, because you will not be disappointed. It's going to really touch that gorehound heart that you all know that you have somewhere inside your cold, desiccated chest.
Yes, keep an eye out for Zombie.
I see what you did there.
Sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at TwoTrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, Two True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the Two True Freaks at the same time.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our brand new website at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Two True Freaks is always spelled TwoTrueFreaks. Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook, too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook, too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."